Hello, you. Welcome to this bonus episode of You Are Good, a feelings podcast about movies about Sex and the City season one. We're putting this here because Sex and the City is streaming in more places than normal. And people are talking about it. So we're putting this here for you. If you are a subscriber on Patreon or Apple Podcast subscriptions, you've already heard this. It's Sarah and me talking about Sex and the City season one. We also cover Sex and the City season two with Eve Lindley. We also cover Sex and the City season three with our illustrious producer, Miranda Zickler. We have an episode on Sex and the City season four coming out. We have bonus episodes about And Just Like That. We have all sorts of content related to all things Carrie. Bradshaw, of course. But we wanted to put this here because people are talking about it. And if you are not a subscriber and you haven't had the opportunity to listen to this, maybe you are like, wow, this is so good. I want more of this in my life. I should subscribe to You Are Good, a feelings podcast about movies, where I will get the weekly content that I already get, feelings in movies, and then I will get these big sprawling conversations about 25-year-old television shows. If you are itching for us to cover TV, this is probably where we're going to do it. Over in bonus land, this is where we already do it. So that's it. I just wanted to let you know that this is here and this is why this is here. If you are not a listener and you're just like, I will listen to anything about Sex and the City, just know that You Are Good, a feelings podcast about movies, is hosted by my great friend, Sarah Marshall, who you'll hear on this very episode, and me, Alex Steed. And we talk about movies and we unpack what we see in the movies and talk about how it helps us understand how we relate to people, to being alive, and to existing in this world. That's what we do. It's fun and heartfelt. And sometimes we cry, and most of the times we laugh. Thank you so much for being here. And before we get into it, I want to just make a plea. I want to make a plea that you don't forget that you, my friend, are good. All right, let's go hang with the gals. Let's talk about Sex and the City season one. And again, if you want more of these over on Bonus Land, we have all sorts of Carrie Bradshaw centered conversations with all sorts of delightful folks. Hello, Sarah Marshall.
Hello, Alex Steed.
Hello, Sarah Marshall.
Ricola. It's impossible to know where to begin.
I don't know where to begin.
I'll begin. We are talking today about Sex and the City, season one, the unloved stepchild of all the Sex and the City seasons, because it's just so weird.
And can you, I guess, like, say a couple of things? One is, for people who haven't listened to our And Just Like That episodes, what is your relationship with Sex and the City? Why is it important for us to be watching the first season? You and me as friends.
Well, I love those questions, but I would actually love to ask you why you were persuaded to do a bonus episode on season one of Sex and the City.
Well, it's okay. So Sex and the City is one of my friend Sarah Marshall's favorite pieces of media. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of always, at least in the past handful of years, but probably longer than that, it's always existed as a frame of reference for something that you bring up relatively, you know, repeatedly. Mm-hmm. We covered And Just Like That, which was kind of funny because, like, I had not seen Sex and the City or, like, seen it in full. Mm-hmm. I'd seen kind of like episodes here and there, or pieces of episodes, usually at a hotel where it's like sped up a mm-hmm. little bit and weirdly edited.
In a way that's very unsettling. Yeah, I hate it when you're watching Sex and the City on E and it's like you feel like you're on acid or something.
Yeah, for sure. But I think, like, also it's just like, I, like you, but maybe to a lesser extent, am always intimidated by the idea of cracking into a new series because it means you have to crack into a new series.
Yes.
But at the same time, it's like, this is something that I've known is so important to you that, like, inevitably it was going to happen because it's like a shared mm-hmm. thing between friends. And it's really nice just to know what a friend's frames of reference are. Mm-hmm. And finally, I was visiting you a couple of weeks ago
And I was just like, let's watch some episodes of Sex and the City. Mm-hmm. And we did. And I was incredibly surprised to see what was presented in the first season, because I think by the time I came to understand what it was, not as a text, but as a cultural phenomenon, I had come to know it as something much different than what was presented in the first season, which is like, in a lot of ways, messy, but incredibly radical, scrappy, lovable commentary on what the coming new millennium was going to mean is for a particular sort of person's intimate affairs.
I'm so happy to hear you say that. And I think one of the things I find most interesting about Sex and the City is that it is one of those media franchises that starts off as one thing and then becomes a completely different thing, and then becomes a third thing, and then a fourth thing. And like, Sex and the City has like died and been reborn so many times at this point. It's like Cher or something, or just like keeps remaking itself and adapting to the market in this amazing way. So like, Sex and the City began its life as a newspaper column by Candace Bushnell, the original Carrie. It was this tart, like an arugula salad with a balsamic dressing kind of commentary on how like a very, in the scheme of things, small number of like chic Manhattanites were living and having sex with each other. And then it was optioned into a show to be on HBO starring Sarah Jessica Parker. And like, it was to become this kind of like episodic primetime soap opera, essentially, with like great jokes and great fashions and like great humor and fantastic writing. And it was like pushing boundaries all the time. But I think fundamentally it became about the girls and their relationships and these long term storylines of like Charlotte and Trey, Charlotte and Harry, Miranda and Steve, Carrie and Big, Carrie and Aiden, Carrie and Berger, Samantha and Richard, Samantha and Smith Jared, you know, and also, of course, the episodic, long running, overarching storylines of their relationships with each other, Miranda becoming a mother, you know. But it started off trying to be something that was like colder and sleeker and I think kind of sharper and therefore harder to cuddle.
Yeah, it's so much closer to Seinfeld than I expected it to be.
It is. And this is starting in the last year that Seinfeld was on, possibly like right after Seinfeld ended, because this is starting in like spring and summer of 98.
Yeah, it's funny because, I mean, it's each episode is very much about a thing. Like, each episode has a theme and it's about that thing. And the overarching theme is sex. But in order to talk about serious things, it wraps it in like very fun irreverence. And it's not to say that it is like disaffected, but like, you know, they talk about things that are serious and can create insecurity in people and make them shut down in a way that's extremely fun. And I like that a whole lot. And I think that it's a great way to sort of attack some of these subjects. And also, like, I like that it doesn't pretend to be everyone's experience. This isn't a like, this is what women are going through in 1998. They're like, this is what we, like, what we four women who are living a very particular lifestyle, who are like white, who are mostly straight. We'll talk about that.
Yeah. We're mostly... Yeah, but the point of the show is like that it was like, you know, Bret Easton Ellis or Jay McInerney or something. Like, this is the story of some like hot, rich, affluent, don't have to worry about very much, just having sort of fancy adventures show, you know, that is not that different in spirit from Falcon Crest. Right. It's like, let's see what the rich people are doing tonight.
Yeah, definitely. Wait, and what was your impression when you first watched this season?
So, okay, so my relationship with Sex and the City, I'll say now, the first episode of Sex and the City I ever watched, I believe, was one from the last season, where Carrie goes with Berger on his scary motorcycle to a theater premiere, which we will talk about later on when we get to it. And it felt like very adult to me. I was amazed that you could say fuck on television. I didn't have an HBO household, but my best friend did. And so I remember just like cramming in HBO like into my cheeks when I went over there like a chipmunk, and then I would go home and think about it. And then I remember it was a show that like the way it kind of gradually trickled down to like plebs was really interesting because then after it had its finale on HBO, it was licensed across various channels, I think. And so it would play on the recently rechristened CW at like 11:30 at night. And so I remember like lying in bed watching Sex and the City on my like tiny little TV that I had gotten moved into my room when I had pneumonia and that my parents never asked to get back. And when they were playing those episodes when I was in high school, that was when I first watched it. It was like really chopped and sliced and diced to try and make it runnable on TV, which was very confusing.
I can't even imagine.
Very hard to follow, Alex.
You'd have to cut just dialogue alone a solid 3 minutes out of a cool 22 minutes of a show.
Well, and also think about the fact that so much exposition happens while people are naked or thrusting.
Right. Yeah, a lot.
Right? People say so much important stuff while thrusting on this show.
Yes.
So I grew up watching it that way. And then when I went away to college, a girl in my dorm had some of the DVDs. So we watched those. So it was until I got to grad school, I did not have a reliable source for Sex and the City. And then when I was in college, you could buy the like pink suede, like very expensive, sure. You know, the box set of the whole thing, which I coveted.
I can see it in my head. Yeah.
But never got. And now I feel like pink suede is a really dumb thing to make something like that out of, because like, wouldn't it get really gross and then you couldn't clean it?
Sure would.
Yeah. And I feel like it's kind of the bane of Michael Patrick King and Sarah Jessica Parker's existence that Sex and the City, once it wrapped and kind of in the years immediately leading up to that, became known as this sort of like hot pink Manolos, cupcakes, bus tours, broad appeal, beloved by the every woman kind of a thing. When really it started off meant to be something kind of, I think, a little bit alienating.
Yeah.
But it's become like just one, I think, one of the major fandoms of American women, which is amazing to me and which I love and I love to be a part of. And so we did our episodes on And Just Like That last year, which I was just like, I could not stop thinking about And Just Like That while it was out. I was so invested in it. I was obsessed with it. Let's be honest. I was. Yeah. And like, there, it was a tough year, but like that show really took the pressure off. And then last November, I was visiting our dear friend Candace Opper for Thanksgiving. And she was like, you really have to listen to the Sentimental in the City episodes of Sentimental Garbage, which is a podcast by Caroline O'Donohue. And for those episodes, she's joined by her friend Dolly Alderton. And I loved those episodes so much. And it really made me think about how, like, not only do I love Sex and the City, but I think it's important that I love Sex and the City.
How do you mean that?
Because, like, the thing I'm saying about it being, like, a shared fandom among so many people, like, I think I need to spend more time, like, honoring the things that I love that much. Mm-hmm. And so to me, it's important to share it with you, kind of inspired by that podcast.
Yeah.
Because you are my friend who I love, mm-hmm. and you have never watched Sex and the City. And to me, it's like fascinating to think about like how you're going to experience this as someone who's newly encountering both Sex and the City and kind of socialization for women mm-hmm. in the ways that that show depicts it. And I'll also say that when I was watching it on the CW, for whatever reason, it mostly played season 6 and season 1 episodes. I think probably because they're, well, I don't know, with season 1 anyway, they're more disjointed. You don't have to worry about breaking up ongoing storylines. But like, I would also watch Seinfeld late at night then. And they do have like similar feelings. And I think watching this episode, watching this season through again, preparing to talk about it with you, the main kind of thematic thought I had about it, and I think Michael Patrick King, unlike many people working in media today, loves themes too much rather than too little. But I think one of the themes at work here is that like looking for love or even looking for sex, the show takes place in a safe universe where people don't fear violence, but you still get humiliated and psychically battered
and assaulted, like from our point of view these days. Like a lot of the stuff that happens in the show is like, mm-hmm. yeah, it's not frivolous stuff. I mean, like, mm-hmm. there's the guy who tries to push down Charlotte's head in a blowjob like many mm-hmm. times, and then her refusal to be interested in that leads to the severance of their relationship. Whereas like if that happened, mm-hmm. if it was exposed on social media that someone did that now, that they would kind of rightfully be canceled.
Well, for whatever that's worth. And if this guy's some random stockbroker, then like nobody's, they'll be like, oh, who's that?
Right.
Well, I have no power here, you know? But right. So, I mean, the show is like of this perspective that like love is a battlefield. And this first season is about Carrie meeting Big and dating him for what in retrospect at the start of season two she says is about a year, which the math does not compute for that.
Oh my god, time math in this season is wild.
Yes, right.
I certainly like when Miranda went through the 3-month dry spell, I was like,
you're like, when did that happen?
I was like, when did that, who is the guy, what is happening?
There's like a quantum mania thing happening with Sex and the City. And I also love how as the series progresses, it takes place in eternal late spring and eternal weekend.
That's great.
Everyone has these high power jobs, but no one's work hinders their ability to do anything unless you needed to for plot reasons.
I did say to Carolyn, like in a way where I think she was starting to think I was slightly ridiculous for how serious I was taking it, as I was like, Big does too many things. Like, Big does too many things. He dates too many people. He's good at cooking and he is great at his job theoretically and has a lot of power, but I've never seen him work. Like, I was like, I don't know how this guy is doing all the stuff that he's doing. And I don't know how he fares later. It sounds like folks are not necessarily huge fans of him. But if you compare the things that Carrie does versus what he does in the first season, Carrie doesn't come out looking super great. And he looks like he has 40 hours in every day.
It's true. Well, and then so the main journey of the first season is like Carrie dating Big, trying to establish an intimacy with him, feeling unable to get there. And at the end of the first season, and this sounds like I'm making this up as I'm saying it, I feel like, but this is what happens. Breaking up with him when he refuses to take her to church with his mother, Marion Seldes.
And her, oh my God, her attachment issues are amazing. And the stuff that she will do to honor her terror mm-hmm. in the face of like of her attachment issues, such as lie to his ex-wife in order to become friends with her. Mm-hmm. But not really be friends, like pursue espionage essentially.
Yeah.
Which is all kind of relatable shit from my 20s.
And by the way, like for anyone thinking we're turning down the like we hate Carrie road, I'm certainly
no.
not.
No, definitely not.
I love Carrie. Carrie is in every woman. Yes. That's the point.
Totally. Like the things that she does, the things that she does are all like certainly things that I have done in adjacent ways out of like, don't leave me, I love you.
Exactly. The new thought I had on this watch was like, Carrie feels like Big can't open up to her and he can't be intimate with her. But Carrie also can't be intimate with Big because they're together for like almost the entirety of this first attempt at their relationship before they spend a night in bed without having sex with each other. And she like has a whole existential crisis about farting in front of him. And they've been together for, I mean, she calls it weeks. In retrospect, they've been together for a year. So who knows how long it is? It's been a while. And I feel like she's attracted to Big because she has the same intimacy issues he does. There, I said it.
Definitely. Definitely. Yeah, I already find Big very interesting as a character. And I don't know. Again, I don't know how he plays out. Interesting as like a foil, essentially, in this season. Hmm. Like, we don't know much about, I mean, we really don't know anything about him. Like, he's on screen, new things are revealed to us as they're revealed to Carrie, which is interesting. Like the fact that mm-hmm. he brings his mother to church every Sunday. You probably know this, but I wonder how much they had a plan for him, because outside of just being like, you know, and I know that we know now that Chris Noth is shitty, but like this character I find is like, for all the times that we see him on screen, like just charming enough, and then he's gone and you don't really think of him anymore because he's like serving as a bit of a foil for Carrie.
Yeah, completely. And it's unclear to me how strongly they felt about him being in the show the whole way through. Mm. when they started off. Can we start by talking about the first episode? Because when you were here, you watched your first episodes, but they weren't the premiere. I actually went off the theory voiced in Sentimental in the City that Valley of the 20-something Guys functions better as a first episode. And so we watched that together.
Yeah, you made that my first episode, which is great.
And now you've seen the actual pilot. So how did that go?
What's the theme of the actual pilot?
Can women have sex like men?
Oh, yeah. I was like, you know, it's hard to have undo the one that I saw, which is the one that has, oh, fuck, what's that guy's name? Oh, who I love.
The guy from Deadwood.
Yeah. Has guy from Deadwood in it. And is that the episode that where they discuss anal or no?
Yes, this is the one where they're in the cab ride with the anal.
I fully agree with this idea that if you have not seen the show, start with that episode. Mm. Because I like how from a storytelling and especially like a moderately cutting edge form of television for what this was and when it came out, I like how we're learning about who these characters are because mm-hmm. we have Carrie. She's already kind of like quoting people that she's talked to, and you see mm-hmm. the people that she's talked to talk to the screen and say the thing that basically they're saying to her as a reporter, which is a really, I know that it gets phased mm-hmm. out, but I think it was cool. Like I thought that was like actually a cool and interesting thing.
I love those things. I wish they'd done it the whole way through.
And you get really great cameos from like people, like Todd Barry is in one of them. You get really great cameos from people who you'll recognize from other stuff. So I like that a lot. And then we meet her friends as a part of this. And in doing so, you know, in the lower thirds, we understand what their professions are. And like, that's cool. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that that's like actually a really cool way to do that.
Miranda's buying that chicken at the salad bar. I love that our first character is established in a sad salad bar.
But the episode where they are discussing anal and the context of Charlotte is presented with that being mm-hmm. a desire of the person who she's with, I feel like more than knowing like who they are and what they do and what their ages are and sort of like what their perspectives are, you really full on get who they are as characters.
Totally.
And it takes a while to get there in the way that it unfolds in the first episode. But like, if you just cut to episode 3 or episode 4, it just throws you into their logic. Mm-hmm. And it's like intimate with them. Like you're embedded in the cab with them, which is super fun. And I do think that serves as like a much better introduction of who they are. I have no complaints about the way that it unfolds, but if you have a choice and you haven't seen this yet, start with the 20-somethings episode.
Nice. So I listened to the audiobook of this original book that was a collection of Candace Bushnell's columns, you know, that was optioned into this. And the first two episodes are pretty close adaptations of those columns. And then Amelita is from the columns. There's like some stuff thrown in. The baby shower episode is pretty closely adapted.
I love the baby shower episode. the existential crisis of like not being the wild thing that was like once the way that you got all of your love and attention mm-hmm. is very familiar.
Yeah. Yeah, you remark on that a lot. Sometimes you get this faraway look and you're like, in the 90s, when I was beautiful.
Well, I also just used to be like loud and like energy and mm-hmm. like would say crazy things. And
you
like,
still
you know,
say crazy things.
I think more often, but yeah. I, in retrospect, I'm like not upset about it because I actually kind of know that like that was just like unmoored chaos. And like that wasn't particular as we see how it plays out.
And now you're moored chaos. That'll be the name of your boat.
Now I'm moored chaos. But like that's the way that they handle that in the episode is fantastic. Mm. Where like someone tries to do the thing that used to get them the attention that felt like love and actual validation. And then seeing people see them through clear eyes mm-hmm. and then realizing how absurd it might have been in the first place and having to reconcile that all at the same time and feel like you're in a new stage in your life and you don't know what to do with that new stage. Like, that's a lot for a show that people reduced as like the show where like women get together and drink apple teenies.
Cosmos, Alex. But yes, completely.
Cosmos,
and
yeah,
of course,
sure.
Tartinis. And in season 2, we get some tartinis. No, completely. And I mean, I feel like this is one of the big kind of themes of our cultural discussions at this moment. For those of us who spend time doing that, I think is kind of looking at media about women and like wondering if like the things that we have taken to be unserious are simply deemed unserious because women are doing them, not because they're unserious and the women are silly because those are the things they want to do.
Yeah. So you were saying that you read the book of essays. Mm-hmm. What does that bring to light? Like, what does going back to the source material bring to light in the context of revisiting the season?
I mean, it's interesting to me how the first episode is kind of like, this is what the show is going to be. It's going to be like these columns, and Carrie is a sexual anthropologist. And every week she poses a somewhat straw man argument. And then by the end of the episode, she's like, actually, something in the middle.
Yeah, it's always like, is monogamy dead again?
Right. And the answer, and you know, the answer is going to be like, well, probably not. Kind of, but not really. But yeah, but no. Yeah.
Right.
And we also got in the pilot episode this amazing thing I've never noticed before. Here are some lines we get. I took notes. Charlotte told me later that she thought she had played the entire evening flawlessly, and Miranda told me later that she thought he was too nice. Throughout the whole rest of the series, whenever Carrie talks about what her friends are doing, she just knows what they're doing. She's there telepathically. Okay. She's omniscient.
Is she a ghost?
In the future, if she were to construct the sentence, she'd say, Charlotte thought she had played the entire evening flawlessly. And something I find amazing about this series, which we never address ever in a really fascinating way, because we can't, because it would be too weird, is like, is it an issue for example, Miranda Hobbs, the corporate lawyer, that her sex life is being written about in the New York Star?
Oh, my God. I think about this all the time.
Me too.
When she went to go talk to Big's ex, and we find out that the ex knew, which I think is like even better. Like, it's like even better to know that like when she went and thought she was being coy, yep, the ex knew, which is great. And this woman's like, I'm a big fan of yours. And it's like, then are you reading the months of columns in which she's talking about your ex-husband?
And presumably she is, right? That's and Carrie's like, oh my goodness, I thought I was being subtle.
I asked you this when we watched the first episode, the 20-somethings episode together. I was curious to know, like, if she and Samantha have a deal about all of the PR work that Carrie is helping bring into Samantha by writing about her all
See?
The time and mentioning her PR firm every time.
I know! And no one cares. Like, for the entire history of the show, the position on this is like, we don't care. We're never going to get into it ever. Which I love, because it would be, because
no,
you could never even start to talk about it without it immediately being so distracting and weird. And there's also, and I'm obsessed with this, there's a moment in season 6 where Charlotte is shopping for self-help books and she buys one furtively. And then she gets all these like Amazon links. I think it was a product placement for Amazon episode where Amazon is like, we thought you'd enjoy these other sad self-help books. And she's like, no. And she throws the self-help book out her window. And Carrie says that it fell on the head of a woman it fell on the floor in front of her, in the ground in front of her. She was okay. But it was just what she needed. And I was like, how does Carrie know what happened to the woman who found the book that Charlotte threw out the window? And so what I really think is that Carrie is like a god.
Carrie's definitely a god. Carrie's a highly confused god, which is great. Yeah, I love this about the tenses. I'm so taken by Skipper, the website maker.
You love Skipper. He was like, when you started watching this is the first thing you texted me about.
I just think that he was the first person I noticed when we were watching episodes of your house. It's just like, I love anything that indicates a time where we didn't know how to talk about the internet.
Yeah.
And Skipper's on-screen title several times is website maker.
I love it. He carves them out of oak.
When we first meet him, he's making Mad Magazine's website. Which is like hilarious. And I understand that they're like, what kind of website would this guy be working on?
Right.
Who looks like a very androgynous Keith Haring, basically. Like,
wow,
that's who Skipper looks like, and obviously is Miranda's love interest. But yeah, I just love that he's a website maker. I like all of the people who we meet along the way, even if we just meet them in passing.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give a rundown of who each of the characters is from your perspective?
Oh my God. So we have Carrie Bradshaw, the relatable every girl who writes a sex and relationships column for the New York Star. And she lives in our pilot episode in a much less aspirational apartment that's next to a huge blinking neon coffee shop sign, which I feel like once you've made a pilot and you have to think about making 11 more of these, you're like, we're not doing that. And she is, how to describe Carrie? It's like describing your own arms. Carrie is scrappy, impulsive. She's very charming. She struggles with self-awareness. And she's fun. She's a fun lady. I feel like she's also just, she's the proxy character for the viewer. And yet she has specificity about her, but I feel like she's also really like kind of there as much as a narrator as a character, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Miranda is our cynical, witty, angry lawyer who dresses like David Byrne. Samantha is like she is like the definition of a blousy blonde.
I just want to offer that I love that description of her dressing like David Byrne. She also just looks like a Kraftwerk album cover all the time. Like, she just looks like
she does. She really does.
She looks like a krautrock model.
Yes, she does. Or like she's in the Addicted to Love video or something.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Samantha is like our playful, just behaves as if she just sprinkles ecstasy over her morning coffee, I would say.
I would argue if Carrie is a god, which I agree with, like that Samantha is Loki.
Samantha is Loki. Yeah.
She's also a god, just in a different direction.
Yeah. And Charlotte is our sex goddess trapped in the hard candy shell of a preppy, and she's gonna spend the series chiseling her way out. I mean, and it's and the show is about like everyone goes on a journey to in some way deal with their baggage in the show, and that's one of the many reasons I love it.
Yes. Well, you've said several times about Charlotte that you think that she's the most sexual character
mm-hmm.
of everybody. How do you mean that?
I think that like this is secretly the canon of the show. And that there are things that happen that demonstrate this in passing. So like the episode where Samantha is like despondent in the finale because she has met this amazing guy named James, who she loves. And she met him at a jazz club, by the way. And she's despondent because he has a very small penis,
mm-hmm.
which I also feel like the show is like very insensitive to people with small penises or erectile issues.
Or who are taking Prozac. Jesus.
Yes, that as well. Yes, I know. I feel like there was this panic in the late 90s that are like, these people on happy pills are just going to watch Blockbuster all day.
Yeah.
But in that conversation, when they're dealing with like James having a small penis and Samantha not being satisfied by it, Charlotte's like, how is he with his tongue? And everyone looks at her like she's nuts.
Totally.
And then in a subsequent episode, they're talking about anal lingus. And Miranda feels really grossed out by receiving it. And I think Samantha and Charlotte are very both pro that. But then they're all like, oh, but I would never give it. And Charlotte's like, really?
I love that. So I had mixed feelings about the very evident blind spots.
Mm-hmm. About so many things.
Yes, for sure. This person has a 3-inch penis, erect. Like, that's an issue for Samantha. There's the issue where a partner of Charlotte's is taking Prozac and can't get an erection as a result.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had issues with like what feels like it is like the punchline a little bit, but also I really liked some of the conclusions. And meaning like Miranda says point blank to Samantha in the issue with the penis size, you know, you had a particular expectation and you are disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like a great lesson. Like, mm-hmm. it could be like that. It's like, I'm so sorry. I from a standpoint of like what I need for sexual fulfillment, like I like getting fucked by people with like a particular dick size. Like in order for this to like proceed, I need this. Like that's what I need. Mm-hmm. And at least you know that moving forward, like it's not necessarily a great thing to learn in real time and have mm-hmm. to break to someone. But like similarly, when Charlotte it runs into the issue with a guy who has Prozac and very inappropriately is like, wouldn't you stop taking Prozac so you can fuck me? Like, so I can have what I want. And he's mm-hmm. like, no.
He's like, we've gone out twice.
I love that so much that he's like, no. And she's like, oh, like I need something else from this. I'm going to go elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And that to me is an important takeaway that doesn't necessarily like negate the fucked up takes mm-hmm. that are happening. But I'm like, it's important for you to know like what is important for you and like what someone can provide. And ideally, like once Charlotte gets a little more time on the rabbit, she can realize that it's not fully essential that you need 100% of your orgasms from the dick of your partner.
Mm-hmm. Same penis forever.
Which is the motto, by the way, if you guys haven't listened to the show regularly, it's the motto of the city of Nashville.
Bachelorette capital of the world.
Oh my God. Do you think we're going to, is Steve going to come back in season two of In Just Like That?
He'd fucking better.
I don't see why he would, I guess. I would love to see him.
But we need to see Steve in a relationship with a really hot person and he's really happy and he's like, I'm so glad I moved on from Miranda. She was such a cold. Well, I won't call her names. It was a good few years somewhere in the, but I lost it. It's a hard voice.
It's so good. It's so good. It brings me so much joy.
Steve's the best.
What are some of your favorite storylines from the season?
Why don't we just read little bits from our notes? Read me some lines.
Hansen shirt.
Yep.
Carrie's wearing a Hansen shirt at some point
mm-hmm.
from the band Hansen. Will you at least lick my balls? Is a line.
Mm-hmm.
Attention deficit disorder masked ball.
Oh my God. I love that one. I love all the medical benefits.
What are some of your notes?
Okay. See that guy? He's the next Donald Trump. Yeah. On the east side, a pseudo lesbian went to a right wing Republican dinner party. Yes, let's talk about that part.
Yeah, so is this storyline there that totally understandably Miranda's boss or one of the partners at the firm mm-hmm. believes that she's a lesbian?
Specifically, John Benjamin believes that she's a lesbian and sets her up with his pal Sid.
Baby John Benjamin is in this episode and he is so great to see.
And we are left to assume that John Benjamin continues to work at Miranda's law firm for the entire time that she's there and that for the whole rest of the series, as she's living her life, falling in love with Steve, dating Blair Underwood, whatever, that every day she goes into work and says hi to John Benjamin.
So she's confused as a lesbian by like a senior partner at the firm.
Well, John Benjamin thinks she's a lesbian and then he sets her up on a date with Sid. And then she has a really great like kind of a date with Sid. And then the senior partner is like, so Miranda, you're gay.
Yes. Yes, he wanted her to come because his wife wanted lesbians in their social circle.
Yeah.
Wild.
They're trying to snag a lesbian.
That's like a liberal thing to do. Not meaning right. like liberals into it, but like that's a like, you know, I have friends of different backgrounds and you go out and like recruit people.
It's literally what Charlotte does and I'm just like that.
It sure is.
With her black neighbor. In case anyone forgot, I mean, how could you if you saw it? It was mortifying.
Oh, my God.
Another thing I have written down in my notes, if your friends won't go down on you, who will?
A classic.
Another Miranda line.
And then another line of hers is essentially, if my dry spell is not up by month four, I'm humping one of you guys.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love for you to talk about your take on Miranda's sexuality through the show, which we know in Just Like That, it's revealed that she is realizing that she's queer.
Mm-hmm.
But like my take on watching this first season for the first time is like, she's naturally queer and they did absolutely so little to hide it. Like in one of the first scenes that we see her, like she's getting a birthday cake delivered and getting like kissed by drag queens in a place where she's like clearly just known by drag queens. Like, and that's one of our first like everything she's wearing. She's upset that they won't ask her to be involved in a threesome with them.
She has a dream subsequently where she's in the sandbox and none of them want to play with her.
Yeah. Miranda is a lesbian.
Yes.
And like, I know that like the actress, I know that Cynthia Nixon is lesbian.
But... here's a thought that I have. And I think that this is true for a lot of people. I think that like the experience of being a woman trying to date and fall in love with and have sex with men is so unpleasant and painful and humiliating that you might not even notice that the enjoyment part is missing because it's so small anyway.
Right. I love that as a read. And obviously I'll learn more as I watch the series. But like, I think there are a lot of ways to read the Miranda that I met in this season.
Right. And I think that like we all have our own relationship with Miranda. And therefore, I think there are like different answers to like, what is Miranda's sexuality? Mm-hmm. But I think that Steve worked for Miranda because he's kind of spiritually a lesbian.
Yeah.
Look at him. And I don't just mean look at him, but I mean like he's
for sure.
He's a bartender and he's cute and he's interested in servicing her and
he looks exactly like this professor in the women's studies program at UMaine named Wendy Chapkis.
Well, there you go.
He's like got like smart denim, like it's like really like nicely cut.
Yes,
like he has like great hair. Like he's like a little
He's like doing masculinity a little bit from the outside in. You know,
totally.
So, like, yes. Of course she was happy with Steve for a while, you know? And I don't really buy the mechanics of him just like that. And I feel like, to me, Miranda's queerness is one where, like, the reason she's not with Steve anymore isn't because she's queer. It's because the show needed to, like, rip them apart.
Yeah. This also, not surprisingly, puts in just like that in a new perspective because, you know... Whatever one's issues, if someone has issues with In Just Like That for whatever understandable reason, if one has issues with In Just Like That, which is just like, you know, why are my girls doing this? Like, why is this the experience they're having? I kind of see it now. Mm-hmm. Like, I see In Just Like That now, not as a logical continuation of who these people were when you last saw them. Mm-hmm. But so this season of Sex and the City is like, we're just meeting these like women in their early 30s in a very particular moment in history. And just like that, we're meeting these women in their 50s in a very particular moment in history. Mm. And it's not necessarily like a continuation. It's like, we took like those characters.
Yeah.
And is it a logical extension of who they were? Like maybe a little bit, maybe not or whatever, but like, we just like put them in this new moment in history and we're seeing what happens as a result. And I think if you see it like that, it's like, it takes a lot of pressure off the show.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's less just like, we owe them a particular obligation to like who they have been, and more just like, what is it like if you take those characters and like put them in 2020, which is, you know, disorienting for everybody.
Yeah. 2021 too. Yeah. And then it's like, the longer you've known them, the harder it is to do that, you know? So I really, it's like, I and many other people feel like Miranda is like a part of me.
I think like a reason why I enjoy this season so much is like, there's a thing that happens when a show is on for more than three seasons where it has to start building something between the characters. Like you can't just have situational comedy where there's like not built upon like chemistry or history between the characters. Mm-hmm. And it's almost always in season three into season four where that starts to like solidify.
That's true, isn't it? That's so interesting.
Yeah, it's almost like it's like, oh God, like we need an arc. I don't know why that is. I don't know if it just feels too superficial if we keep showing up and there isn't like a history or sort of a shared timeline. And like, there's plenty of shows where I like them regardless of the arc, even if I disagreed with the arc. But I don't know, there's like a lovely and fun chaos to the disjointed nature of a show that is not yet trying to create a very deep arc. Mm-hmm. Like even in this, like will they, won't they about Carrie and Big, again, like, he's more at this point just like a foil to show us like who Carrie is than mm-hmm. he is like someone that we're like really invested in her being with.
I got news for you. He's always a foil. Okay. And like, you know, you can be more or less invested in him, but it's like, I'm fascinated by Big, and actually I would love to talk about Big and cooking and Big and the kitchen. And one thing I noticed watching episode 11 that I've never put together before, I had noticed that like when they're trying to show that Big and Carrie are happy, like consistently through the show and into the movies, they're in the kitchen together. You know, she's got some corn, they've got some veal, you know, this is what's happening when things are going well. And I noticed that in this episode, Big also, I don't think he has a dining table. He likes to eat at the kitchen bar, and that's where they're sitting and eating when he puts the whoopee cushion on her chair. And I wrote in my notes, Big eats at the kitchen counter like a little draper.
Yeah, I mean, he's like, he doesn't have, from what we know about his dating life, he was married once, he fucked around, and he seems to just have extremely finite, shallow relationships with women. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that he's necessarily, I think like having an opportunity to like eat at the table with somebody is like a great way to show that like there's some like potential here, because like he's still like, he's 8 years old.
Yeah. And like, how do you feel about Carrie and Big? Like, do you care? Do you believe in it?
No, I don't care. I don't care at all.
Uh-huh. Say more about how you don't care.
There's nothing about it. He's just facts. Like, what is he doing differently that like another man we've seen on the show would do? We don't know. Like, there's like nothing to this point presented. He seems like an objective for mm-hmm. her.
Yeah.
You know, I want to be seen by a particular sort of person.
Right. And she's got this thing about how he's so perfect and she's the girl who farts. And it's like, and this whole season is about like, Big can't commit, but really it's also about Carrie, like, you know, just losing her mind continually for no reason, which I get because that's what I like to do.
I do like, we're to the point where you said that like she is in every woman, and this isn't a matter of like shitting on her, like everything that she's done where I'm like, ugh, I was like, ugh, because I've done it.
Right.
And at the same time, like Big is like kind of like meticulously created in that, like, you know, when she thinks things are going great and then she sees him out to dinner with another woman and she's like, I thought you had a work thing. He's like, no, I said I had a dinner. And and that's like, I've certainly been in a situation where I'm like, I thought this thing was happening. It's like, no, I never said that this thing was happening. Mm-hmm. And it's like, do we have to have a conversation about this? Is that that time? And like, I've certainly been in Carrie's shoes where it's like, oh, I understood this other thing and it's actually this thing. The way that like Big functions to reveal these things about Carrie is super interesting, but like, I don't care about him.
And I don't think that you'll ever care about him because he never gets developed as a character. Like, he gets developed a bit more.
His name's Big.
I know. His name's Big.
It's not like Tony. It's like his name is an avatar.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
And I know later we meet people who have real names. And I know because of your Eves in my group chat.
Right. Aiden is a real name. It's not like the next guy she dates is named Mr. Medium. That would be, although he kind of is. And then Berger is Mr. Small. And Petrovsky is Mr. Old.
I can't believe his name is Berger. Who plays Berger?
Ron Livingston.
Oh, great. That's a great name for Ron Livingston.
I mean, the thing is, I normally like Ron Livingston and stuff, but this is just, anyway, we won't get there for a while. So yeah, season one is like in that realm of freedom where the show is like figuring out what it can do and what works. And it feels like they're trying a few different things. And I agree with you. I think what you're saying is that the baby shower episode like works the best dramatically of these like original column content episodes.
I love that episode.
Mm-hmm.
Because the other episodes are like, you know, to your point, is monogamy a thing? And then we see it from four different perspectives. Mm-hmm. And then we draw a conclusion, which is like, a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
I like the idea of Carrie as like a mobster. And they're like, so what do you think, Don Carrie? And she's like, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. The end.
And so I like how in that episode, it's like, it actually takes you on a journey of mm-hmm. seeing somebody see who they were and see who they are now and are not entirely sure of what to do with it. What is your read or feel of that episode?
I love that episode. I love the episodes where the girls all go somewhere together. And I was thinking, watching this season, I love that all the episodes where they go to a side character's wedding, which there are three of that I can think of, which I think is very high. There's the Turtle and the Hare in this season, where they go to Caroline / Carolyn from 16 Candles' wedding. Did you recognize her?
Yes, I did.
They go to Miranda's interior decorator's wedding in the chicken dance in season two. And they go to Bobby Fine's wedding at the end of season five. And I believe I Love a Charade. And that's great. It's like you get to sort of see how they're doing and sort of how they interact with the world. And so then we get like the baby shower episode. We get two episodes in season three where they go to LA. Oh, and then we get an episode in the start of season three where they all go to Staten Island to judge a hot fireman contest.
That's amazing. I'm excited.
Also, this is a season where Carrie is like actually looking critically at like babies, point counterpoint, marriage, point counterpoint. Like, I love that episode three of this season is Carrie being like, marriage, am I interested? And like the fact that she's even asking that question of herself feels like incredible in a show that came out in 1998.
Yes. Yeah. I like that, to your point of like these being episodes where they go somewhere, I like that. And I know, like, obviously, like anything where New York is in it, there's the cliche of like New York as a character or whatever. But I like that they're like their Cheers or like Jerry's apartment is just New York.
Yeah.
Like they're out doing New York things. And then like, they could be at a wedding in New York, but like that's not in New York. That's like at the wedding. And so like those are the episodes where like you see them in a unique location. But I enjoy, I mean, just like thinking about like the heavy lift of like the logistics of making New York your set.
Yes.
Is itself incredibly ambitious.
Well, and there's so many shots where like they're walking on the street and like you can see pedestrians like looking at them, looking at the camera, taking pictures of them occasionally. And you just have to deal with it, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Well, especially at this point, it's, you know, they're not closing streets. They're just like doing run and gun scenes of these women. You know, the show doesn't have its prowess yet.
No, nobody cares. The way they're kind of appearing in different parts of Manhattan, I think, is really...
Right.
It really is one of the most appealing things about it, and how it makes you, as someone who perhaps has never set foot there, feel really worldly, because you know like what your little New York City avatar characters are doing and where they're eating and stuff.
Right. Right. And it's so, you know, it's so specific to the city. Like, I love LA so much. And I think the closest I could be to relating to the show, even though I lived in New York for 2 years, like the closest I could be to relating to the show is just like being in and around LA when I'm there. But like the thing is about LA is like, because you kind of drive everywhere because of how the city is set up, you're not as likely to just like cover the expanse of like interior geography that they do in the show. Like when you live in New York, like there's a chance, you know, you're going to be in like five or six different kinds of places by foot in a single day. And that's what we see. Like, we see them in so many different kinds of interiors, and we really do immerse ourselves in that city in a way where, again, like in LA, like you go like one place in a day and then you call it a day.
Well, and also that you can like, that you can be totally insulated between places, right?
Yes,
that you're like, you're in a car and then you're in place one, and then you're in a car and you're in place two, but there's not a feeling of like being a needle going through a tapestry.
Right. Well put. Yeah. And one thing that I brought up to Carolyn was, I was like, wow, you know, like people used to bump into each other a lot in this show.
Yeah.
She was like, yeah, this show led me to believe that that happened way more often than it does.
I kept track of the way the girls are meeting the men they date as I was watching this. And I'm just going to read you some. I think it's very interesting. Runs into an ex while having lunch with Stanford Black. Collides with a handsome financier immediately after sex with ex and spills condoms everywhere. Set up by her friend Carrie. Met him in a nightclub where he goes to find someone to have sex with after going on a first date with your friend Charlotte. It's all the pilot. riding the same elevator line for years. Meets a model because her friend Stanford Black manages him. Meets her friend Carrie's friend Barkley at a runway show. Surprise setup by married friends. He's Charlotte's doorman. Dates her friend Carrie's boyfriend after he's too marriage obsessed for her. Does PR for his restaurant. Her friend does PR for his friend's restaurant. He's friends with her international party girlfriend. Kicks him in the face during a kickboxing class. And then I also was keeping a list of dropped elements. And one of them is this coffee shop on 73rd and Madison, where Carrie allegedly goes to write all the time and which never, ever, ever comes back. I love that. They were just like, ah, no.
Yeah, it's too much. Oh, my God.
I love dropped elements of shows. I just think it's so fascinating. It's like watching a cat, like, situating themselves to, like, leap to something of a certain height, you know?
Can I say one radical thing that is not radical at all, but I think will be radical to some listening, is like this season is like exceptionally smarter than like a Quentin Tarantino movie, right? which is at this time getting celebrated for being like they're telling stories. They're sort of, he's like inverting the way that like time works in stories or like chronology or like where, you know, someone's like talking to the camera, like all these like tropes or whatever that he will get a free pass on for the rest of his career, essentially, that he was like, that he made the first movies that had broader critical acclaim at a particular time doing these particular things would sort of get a pass forever. This show has like a lot of like the cleverest tropes from like indie movies in the 90s. And again, got written off as like the show where the four sluts drink Cosmos, you know,
which like it is. And there's nothing wrong with a show sluts, but there's also so much more. But and like what comes to mind for you for that?
Just like right out again, like right out the gate with regard to like this is effectively a sex comedy. Right. And to this point, all that we know, like American Pie hasn't even, and I'm not comparing these things to American Pie or whatever, but like sex comedies are all almost exclusively male. They're exclusively male. They are not about acknowledging sort of like any depth of female characters. And they are told in an extremely linear, like A, B, and C happens, resolution occurs, etc. And in this, like, again, like we have them talking to the camera. We have them breaking the fourth wall. We have them arriving at ambiguous conclusions. There's no moralism in the show outside of like people taking like individual moral stances. It's funny. It's darkly funny. It's doing a lot of things that like, again, like by the time I knew this, it was like the movies had come out. And so like maybe like the only way I knew it was like how the movie was marketed on TV.
And how, like, what was your perception of that? Like, what did it become by then? Or at least what was it being marketed as?
Like Pinot Grigio mom TV.
Right.
And I don't mean that in a negative way, because like, I know I'm not trying to like take away the validation from that. But like when I say that and think about my friends, parents who were wine moms, like they weren't necessarily like, it wasn't necessarily about sort of like watching things that were like super critically interesting. It was like, by that time it was like, I don't have a lot of bandwidth.
Yeah.
Like I'm doing a lot.
And now you and I are like both wine moms by that definition. So that's nice.
Yes, we most certainly are. But like, I didn't think of it again. It was so at that point wrapped up in a will they, won't they across the board.
Yeah.
That it wasn't necessarily, you know, I think interestingly, and it's not to say anything negative about a will they, won't they, but I think like the way that you broaden appeal is a will they, won't they. And the reason I say that is because like, you know, like we said, like these issues that they're dealing with are from the perspective of very particular sorts of women in a very particular stage in their life with a lot of different comforts. But what appeals to a lot of people, even if you are not going to be a high-powered lawyer like Miranda, is like, how do you talk to your friends and will you or won't you? And so everyone who maybe felt alienated by the specifics of the earlier parts of the episode will find themselves hooked in the human drama, I guess.
Yeah. And I've made the joke to you that like everybody in the course of the show has to grow on the show except Carrie, who just kind of runs out the clock until Big gets his shit together. And I feel like the more charitable read is that like Carrie also has to grow and learn how to be intimate. And then she and Big like theoretically both grow enough to be able to like have a good relationship with each other. And I believe that, but I guess wish we could have seen the good relationship just even once. I think the closest we actually came to seeing it was in Sex and the City, the movie 2. But the problem is that that movie is such a hate crime that it's practically not canon.
It's interesting that you say that she was essentially trying to outrun the clock, because she says something, and I think that maybe this was the appeal for women who maybe by this time, you know, had had children, were sort of like enmeshed in their careers, had like limited capacity for going deep with friends in the ways that they once did. Mm-hmm. Because like Carrie says in that episode, in the baby shower episode, like, because she believes that she might be pregnant, mm-hmm. she's trying to like make a case that she's like, there are plenty of moms who are like still able to do all of the things that they're doing and like are still interesting, mm-hmm. even though they're moms. Like, I think in a lot of ways, like this is a fantasy of, you know, women who, because of a lot of luxury and privilege, are able to like still carve out space for themselves, mm-hmm. no matter how many responsibilities are hoisted upon mm-hmm. them and how unfairly they are compensated for those responsibilities. And so if you are a person in that position, like you can watch this and like be a fly on the wall with these friends who still have that space, mm-hmm. and it's a fantasy to be able to enjoy that space from time to time in your life in a place that doesn't necessarily like allow that.
Totally. Yeah. I do think that the greatest overarching fantasy of Sex and the City is that these four friends are all able to get together and go, you know, have breakfast or lunch or drinks or whatever multiple times a week. Have you ever tried to get four adult women together? It is impossible. This is why people get married. They need to get their four friends together.
Yeah, multiple times a week. Exactly. Like my closest friend, with the exception of you, who I work mm-hmm. with, and as mm-hmm. a result, we get to see each other often.
Talk to every 25 minutes.
Right. My closest friends, I see maybe four times a year, if mm-hmm. even.
Which is like pretty good, I would say. That's pretty good.
I think so, absolutely. And they're scattered in geography. Yeah. It's, they're not, we don't live in New York. I mean, that's, yeah, and that's part of the hilarious part of the fantasy. Like, I remember when I lived in New York and everyone from Maine was like, what's it like? What do you see celebrities and like, what's it like? And I was like, I'm on the train mm-hmm. all the time. Like, I don't, there's no time for doing anything.
The train
else.
That Sex and the City famously never acknowledges.
There's not one train in Sex and the City. Mm-hmm.
I love how Carrie, at the end of the pilot, she can't get a cab and she's like, I guess I'll have to walk home. And it's like, oh, she doesn't know about the subway. No one has told her. Actually, I take that back. She takes the subway in the season 6 premiere, but we don't see her on the subway. We don't get on the subway until Miranda embarrasses herself in front of Nia Wallace, which you've seen. So,
oh my God.
Oh, the journeys we go on these with these girls. You know, it's because you feel like you've been through so much together. You know, their lives have been such roller coasters, and I've seen it all.
They're like the A-team.
Samantha's like, honey, I love it when a plan pans out. That's what they say, right? On the A-team.
I love Samantha so much. I love this character so much. I cannot believe they have made one season of a sequel that I have watched mm-hmm. without Samantha.
I know. Say more about Samantha. I love her so much.
I love that there is someone as confident and without shame or a hang up about that confidence, about exactly what she wants and how she wants mm-hmm. it. And not even just like as a woman, like as anybody,
it's
to
true.
Want the things that she wants and to pursue them.
Yeah, because men aren't confident either. They just read as confident to women because they're unconfident using different behaviors.
Well, they wear the armor of patriarchy, which is like a performance of confidence.
Right,
it's
that's
not
true.
Real confidence.
Right, that's why they murder people out of humiliation so much. Confident people don't do that.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And she does... You know, I'm joking, but like, it's for like, she does feel like a god.
Yeah, she is a god.
She feels like is not of humans. And that's great.
I feel like Samantha feels like a god or an alien or something, like somebody who has like lucked into this like gently used human body and is just like having the time of her life piloting it around Earth.
Yes, I love her. if she runs into a hang up that like Charlotte has, she's not like, you're an idiot for having that hang up. Mm-hmm. She's just like, it is just obvious that there's no reason to have that hang up. Like, she's not ever diminishing.
She's like, honey, you haven't heard the good news about anal.
You may be on your knees, but you still have him by the balls.
Exactly.
Like, she just, again, it is like an alien thing where she just speaks about it so factually and so clearly and confidently that I imagine, like, again, if you're watching this and you're experiencing your sexuality for the first time and you don't have TikTok and you don't have people engaged in like quote unquote discourse, you don't have all that, like, you just have someone who's mm-hmm. speaking about sex plainly and from a pleasure standpoint and like with zero imposition of like emotional or cultural expectation, what a blessing.
Yeah, and I think that of all the characters, her positions age the best by far.
Yeah.
And it's also really interesting to me, I was realizing this watching the first episode, that like it's kind of this like fascinating thing throughout the show that like we don't get to see Carrie do very much sexually, because all the other actresses will, but Sarah Jessica Parker won't. For whatever reason, which is her right. I'm not against it. But it's like, it's fascinating to me how the show has to like make you feel like you've seen her having sex when in fact you haven't.
Yes.
And it's like the blood in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah.
And in the first episode, we see more sex stuff from her than anywhere in the rest of the show, because we hear her like sort of having a slightly comedic orgasm while being eaten out by the guy from American Psycho.
Yeah, I found that, again, as a person who only knew about this a little bit from the outside, I found how, she's not unsexual, but the least sexually adventurous character being the protagonist is like a funny punchline how the show is known from the outside.
Yeah, like not only do we not get to see her have sex, but the sex she does have sounds boring. Like, yes. What do we honestly think Big is into, you know?
Just sexing.
Big's sexual relationship is with Veal. Yeah, he is into sexing. Yeah,
he just sexes. That's it. He doesn't. That's as far as it goes with Big.
Yeah, and we know that they're not communicating well about this. Like, do you feel? I'm sure that she wants stuff from him that she's never brought up.
Well, she's X far into this relationship and farts for the first time.
I know.
And so she's not like, you know, I need you to do it this way.
No.
Like, that is not happening. That's nowhere close to happening.
She's like, that was great.
Yes. Although his, I will say, his whoopee cushion joke, I laughed out loud.
That was an amazing moment to me, because I was watching it and I was like, you know, this to me feels like the moment where a relationship gets good, right? Where like, you can laugh together. And Carrie's like, oh no. And I have like truly minimal relationship history, I would say. But I was like, Carrie, you're like 32. Surely you should not be this depressed by the relationship like getting good, honestly.
Well, so like essentially like what happens, and we've said this however many times to this point already, but like essentially what happens is like Carrie experiences or observe something, and then we get it processed through the multiple lenses of her friends, and through that we like come to, not certainly not a truth, but we come to a multi-dimensional view of that. In this case of the fart, you know, Miranda finally says like, will you knock it the fuck off? It's not about the fart.
Yeah.
Which is like great advice. Like, this is about like your expectations of like what and how you should be. And that is inhibiting you.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe like Big is allowing for that. And he's not like helping to create and facilitate opportunities for communication. I assume that that's the case.
I mean, just look at him. Yeah.
Just look at him. But like, this is about like what Carrie thinks things have to be like, and is struggling with maintaining a healthy relationship mm-hmm. with those assumptions and like actual reality. Like, you're gonna fart. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Mm-hmm. It's gonna happen.
You are. You're gonna fart so much. What wrapping questions should we have about Sex and the City?
Oh, that's a great question.
Where in Sex and the City's New York would you like to go?
Oh, that's a great question.
Of the stuff you've seen. Thanks.
That's a great question. As a person who is stuck in suspended animation a little bit, I want to go mm-hmm. to the club where they hang out with their 20-something friends.
You loved that club.
They're hanging out at this club, and I had thought, because this was the first episode I watched, they're trying to convey that we are among a certain New York sort, a certain age. Mm-hmm. And so they played so many songs that were popular when I was in high school. They played like a Morphine song. They played like a couple other songs that I was popular from high school. So I'd expected episode to episode, we would have like a tour through everything I listened to in high school. No, it's just this cool club that they went to and hung out at.
That looked like the kind of place that even in 2007, I would have gone to, like downtown on a weekend away from Bennington.
Yes, for sure. That's great. Where would you like to go?
I want to go to the club in the finale with like the fallen angel dancers in cages that Stanford has invited everyone to a party for I forget what. That's where I want to go.
That's great. That's excellent. Well, fantastic. We watched season one of Sex and the City.
In conclusion, I do think that this is a smarter season. This is the season that is kind of standing in the corner with a drink in its hand. And then as this show progresses, it's about getting like dragged into the action and realizing that you can't be smart all the time.
Yeah, this is a show that was made by people who just made really exceptional student films. I love it. Well, thanks for taking me on this journey. It was fun.
Honey, thank you for coming.